I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to Countercurrents Radio. This is another one of our weekly podcasts. And this week we have two things on the agenda. First, we're going to talk about the state of white nationalism in America in the aftermath of the Shelbyville protests last weekend and the conversations and sometimes fights and arguments that have taken place since then. And then Mike and John are going to talk about their time last weekend in Slovenia, where they went to see a big Laibach event. So before we get into both of those, though, I would like to talk about a few donations. In the last 4 days since I've done an update, we have received 7 new donations, totaling $253. $4 a month from Austin, $1 a month from Blondie, $50 from Justin, $100 from IRL, $25 per month from Tim, $30 from Sally, $40 per month from Val, and $3 per month from Monty. And the total amount now of our fundraiser is $47,881.06. We are aiming to get to $60,000 by the end of the year, and I have no doubt in my mind that we will make that as long as our supporters keep coming forward, stepping up, and actually pressing the button. We are still getting back monthly donors that we lost more than 2 months ago with the big deplatforming that followed the Charlottesville rally and the moral panic that took place after that, and the purge that the left basically pressured a lot of businesses to undertake. So we are still in a hole, basically, and we're fighting to get ourselves back out of that hole. And anything that you can do as a Countercurrents reader and supporter is most appreciated. We have 150,000 unique visitors to this website every month. We have fewer than 400 people in a year who actually step forward and give us money. All the rest of you guys out there, you all are free riders, and it would be great with each passing week if we could convert a few more free riders into paying supporters, because you are only able to listen to this. I'm addressing the free riders out there. You are only able to listen to this because other people have been stepping up and helping us out, because we would not be here without donors. So thank you to all the donors that are making this possible. And those of you who have been listening and reading for free for some time, it's time for you to step up and become one of the contributors that make this possible for other people in the future. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, everybody. Every bit counts. That's a cliche, but it's absolutely true.
Yes, thank you, everybody. I see these donations coming in every week, and it's always encouraging to see new people coming into the fold. And for the ones of you that are stepping up, it really means a lot. I just want to underscore that. So thank you.
What John said, that every little bit counts, is really true. When we lost all of our monthly donors, the people who made large donations immediately stepped back up and donated again. But the people who made small donations apparently thought that they didn't make much difference. And if that was only true of one or two of them, if only one or two of them thought that, it wouldn't have made that much difference. But a lot of the smaller donors thought, what possible difference could my $5 or $10 a month make? And because so many of you thought that, it did make a big difference. So we got back all of our larger donors, and maybe 15% of the people who are making $10 and $5 a month donations. We really want to get you back, because those things do add up, and they are a significant portion of our support. So if you were making a small amount, please come back and make a small donation again, because every bit helps. Thank you. So let's talk about Shelbyville and the American movement. And just to recap a bit, for those of you who have heard a bit about this, and some of you, of course, out there have not heard anything about it, perhaps. Last weekend in Shelbyville, which I understand is the neighboring town of Springfield in The Simpsons.
Yes, indeed, where people are allowed to marry their cousins.
This is getting richer and richer, isn't it? Well, no, this is a different Shelbyville, actually. This is in Tennessee. And there was a rally put together by the Traditionalist Worker Party and certain Southern Nationalists. Matt Parrott and Matt Heimbach and also Hunter Wallace were very prominent in this event and discussing it afterwards. And the event was supposed to be one of three events that were held on the same day. There was something to happen in Shelbyville, then something else in a neighboring town, and then they were talking about some kind of candlelight vigil. or Torchlight Rally or something like that later. The Shelbyville event happened. There were large numbers of Antifa types there. The police did their jobs and contained them, so there wasn't any sort of riot or anything. The other two events were canceled. It was a pretty cold and windy day, apparently, and there was a lot of opposition milling around, and so they decided to cancel the latter two parts of the event. Now, the main criticism that's been brought forward of this was that it was a collection of people who sort of come from the white nationalism 1.0 world, people who were National Socialists and KKK members wearing fascist uniforms, not really sharp-looking fascist uniforms oftentimes, but kind of bedraggled-looking, ill-fitting ones. And the overall aesthetic of the thing just looked bad, according to the critics. It was cringe-inducing. It was embarrassing. And it helps the media, the enemy, paint a portrait of our movement as something super marginal. And that's useful to the left to scare people away. John was talking about after the second major event in Charlottesville, the one with the riot, that he was talking to people about this, and people were saying, oh, these are a bunch of Nazis. And John was saying, no, they're not a bunch of Nazis. You have to take this seriously, blah, blah, blah. And then they would post a picture of the one guy in the group carrying the swastika banner. And that was sort of the end of discussion. And we have to recognize that for a lot of normies out there, and they are the people we are trying to persuade, it's a conversation stopper to see the KKK or the National Socialists out marching around. It's a conversation stopper. Most people do not want to identify with such people, and they do not want to have their politics and their interests be championed by such people. And the argument that I think is valid here is that in the United States, we have a long tradition of white consciousness, pro-white policies. From 1790 to 1965, our immigration and naturalization policies were premised on the idea of creating and preserving a white supermajority in the country. That is effective white supremacism, if you will, since, of course, there were other groups in the country as well. And that has been dismantled within the lifetimes of many people who are listening to me today. So this is not something that is alien to America at all. It's not at all. And if we are going to represent the authentic racial interests of white Americans, doesn't it make sense to graft our policies on the living trunk of the American political tradition and on policies that have actually existed in the past? So bringing in stuff that seems quite alien, either in time or place or both, the KKK is very alien in terms of time, and it's been effectively stigmatized as a bad brand, and not necessarily entirely by their enemies, I might add. And then, of course, National Socialist stuff and fascist stuff from interwar Europe, that is not only alien in time and place, and again, very effectively stigmatized. And it seems, I think, self-defeating to throw away American traditions and symbols, especially now, and this is a point that Andrew Anglin has put out there, I think, quite cogently, especially now that the American flag is being decried as a symbol of white supremacy and white racism. It just seems like it's a foolish and self-defeating strategy. Very large percentages of white Americans have a favorable opinion of Thomas Jefferson, a favorable opinion of George Washington, and a very disfavorable opinion of Adolf Hitler or Benito Mussolini. And if we can advance pro-white policies grafted on the living trunk of the American political tradition and point to people like Jefferson and Washington, that makes our work a lot easier. And we want to win. And if we want to win, we have to figure out how to do that most effectively. And so the critics of the Shelbyville event, I think, have a very good point that it's not the right way of going about it in terms of optics, in terms of symbolism. We should cleave to the American tradition, and the American tradition is quite white nationalist. It's quite sensible. It's quite surprisingly sensible. And there's a wonderful collection of writings edited by S.T. Joshi, who's better known as a scholar of H.P. Lovecraft. It's called Documents of American Prejudice. And it's a, for him, of course, he's a East Indian, Yoshi is trying to document what a horrible racist country America is from the start. When I read it, I thought, my God, what a sensible, enlightened country America was from the start. Race realism was as American as apple pie and the red, white, and blue for a very, very long time. And I think we can build upon that rather than build upon other elements of the American tradition, such as radical individualism and things like that, which are, I think, destructive of the integrity of any society or any race. So that's important, I think, to try and cleave to the American tradition, not in the form of civic nationalism or Republican patriotardism or anything like that. The point we're trying to make, and I think Anglin believes this too, is that those people are misrepresenting America. The people who stand on the right and wear their blue suits and their little flag lapel pins and say that America's a proposition nation, they're lying. They're lying. That's not the truth. America was founded by and for white people and their posterity. They envisioned this as a white republic. Even though it had some alien elements to it, it was normatively white, and the immigration and naturalization policies were designed to keep it that way. So this is not the kind of society that we should simply dismiss in toto, and if we're trying to win, we can't do that anyway.
You've done a number of very interesting articles on that theme that I have to say, when I read them, it changed my thinking about it, because I used to be of the type that, well, you know, America was corrupt from its foundations. But, you know, I thought you did a very good job of pointing out that actually, you know, the idea that America is not a country for those of European descent is very recent.
Yeah, it is very recent. All that civic nationalist melting pot stuff, that is a very recent phenomenon, and it was imposed largely, and it was one of the first agenda items of the organized Jewish community to push the idea that America is not based on race or identity, especially white racialism and European identity, but simply based on a proposition. Now, in the 19th century, there were people like Daniel Webster, a sort of radical, the radical left of their time, that wanted to argue that America was a proposition nation. And basically what all of these people do is they take the Declaration of Independence and really just the opening of it, where it talks about all men are created equal, and then they say that this is a legal founding document of the United States, which isn't true. It's not a legal document. But they use that bit of rhetorical puffery and flummery that that Jefferson put out there, which simply means, by the way, it's simply a denial of hereditary status and rank. It doesn't mean anything else than men are born equal in the sense that some people do not have a hereditary right to rule over others. It's a republican principle. It's a denial of the monarchical principle, the hereditary monarchy and hereditary aristocracy of Britain. That's it. But what people do is they take that out of context, turn it into some kind of absolute moral principle, and then use it as a heuristic to interpret the Constitution, which says nothing about human equality, but treats Indians as alien, savage nations, and treats blacks as three-fifths of a person only for the purpose of apportioning congressional representation, which, you know, obviously that means they're not citizens. I don't know why they should count at all, frankly, for congressional representation. But of course, the people in the slave-owning states wanted more representatives, and they had the power to get that done, right? So even that was a fatal compromise, I think. But it did strengthen the slave-owning states in the legislature. But I wrote a piece called Is White Nationalism Un-American? It's at Countercurrents. I really recommend that.
Me too.
And there's a piece that I wrote about Paul Gottfried's book on Leo Strauss and American conservatism. And in there, I talk about how Straussians and earlier Jewish intellectual movements were responsible for pushing the idea that America was founded on Lockean liberal principles. And they had, of course, an interest in that idea, because that conception of America doesn't exclude Jews, whereas the original conception of America really did. They were considered outsiders in the American system. It doesn't mean that they weren't allowed to be here. They were allowed to be here, but they were considered outsiders because America was considered a normatively white and Christian country, and that was embodied in the first Immigration and Naturalization Act, which basically opened immigration to Christians, white Christians of good character, basically. Free white people of good character, but they were thinking in terms of Christians. So I recommend that stuff.
I was traveling last weekend, so I have to admit I've only read a couple of articles on what happened in Shelbyville. I do have a general idea of what happened, and it just seems like it's another in a string of these events, which I really don't think are. I know there's people out there who could argue with me about this, but that I don't really see as being constructive, except impressing the small circle of people who are already fans of these groups. I'm probably going to be accused of being cowardly or whatever. I mean, I am in favor of real world events, but I don't know that this kind of 1930s style, you know, street battles is, you know, especially when they're not even allowed to fight because, of course, I mean, if you look at the Weimar Republic, you had the communists and the National Socialists fighting, but that's because the Weimar government was extremely weak and the United States government is not weak at all. So, I mean, they're managing all of these events. So other than, you know, I guess it gets them visibility, but I don't see it as actually any kind of achievement or how you could claim it's any sort of a victory. The two Matts, I mean, I've known both of them for a while. I've met both of them. And even though we disagree on some things, you know, I generally like both of them and so forth. But I just don't see these events as really achieving what we want to achieve. I mean, the moment we had after the election, you know, I do believe that we had an opening and maybe we still do. I'm not saying for sure that it's closed, although I think, you know, Charlottesville and some of the other things that have happened have made it much more difficult as far as the mainstream public goes. But I really think we had a moment to construct some kind of new type of right wing movement. And I mean, if I look at what's really happening and what I think could actually bear fruit in the long run, I mean, of course, I disagree with some of the sorts of things that Breitbart and Steve Bannon advocate or believe in or whatever. But at the same time, I feel like they're really going somewhere. Bannon seems to really be trying to develop a new sort of populism by basically he said he's going to try to create a new faction of the Republican Party. Okay, it's not perfect, but I'm reminded of, you know, we've been running a series of articles by Michael Walker on the website in relation to Brexit, which I strongly encourage people, if they haven't read them, to go and read them. They're ostensibly book reviews, but he really presents a lot of interesting analysis. And something he says in several of them is that, you know, you have to give up on this idea of ideological purity, because if we wait around for a leader, a movement that 100% agrees with their ideals, it's going to be too late if it ever appears. We have to work with what's going on. And even though, you know, we can certainly point out many flaws in the people behind Brexit and the people behind Trump and so forth, they are nevertheless improving things for us. And they are at least somewhat, I think, disrupting the establishment's narrative. So I really think I'm not against real world events. I really don't think that things like Shelbyville are doing anything other than shoring up the support of a very small minority of people who are not politically significant in the United States.
Yeah, I think that it does encourage people in the far right, perhaps. But I think that overall, they might be setting us back. They might be setting us back in public consciousness, and they might also be setting the movement back in terms of our organizations, our power, and our funding. And this is the other line of criticism. First, it just looked wrong. It didn't look like something that normie Americans who are basically on our side in so many ways can identify with, and therefore they're not going to follow it. They're going to be repulsed by it rather than attracted to it.
Exactly. I've certainly seen that among my own family and friends.
Right, right.
And I can't really blame them.
I think there has to be a middle ground, though, because, you know, we can't count on Steve Bannon and everything he's doing with Breitbart to carry the day. We can't compromise on the race question. But
let me just clarify, Mike. What I'm getting at is not that we should stop what we're doing and only become supporters of Bannon or whatever, but you know, I sort of see us as the radicals who can kind of influence things from outside. But we're, at least not for the time being, we're not in the mainstream. But I think if we restrict ourselves to these cultural and more intellectual activities that we're doing, that's really where the important work from our side is being done. Whereas, these events, I think, you know, like Greg said, at best, they're only shoring up the base, and at worst, you know, they're actually setting us back. I agree with that.
Yeah, and in terms of shoring up the base, well, maybe it helps the commitment of some people, but I think it's actually undermining our movement. And I want to expatiate on that argument a little bit. Over the last decades, white nationalist ideas, European ethno-nationalist ideas, have been largely online and in books, magazines, and through networking and private events. And that has been laying certain metapolitical foundations for political change. And the fact that there are all kinds of terrible consequences that we are now reaping from multicultural policies, those things are red-pilling people, awakening people, and so forth. And then some of them come to our ideas on the internet, and we are able to articulate what's going on better. And we're producing converts. We're changing people's minds. Events are driving this. We are capitalizing on it and helping it along to some extent, but I do not believe that we have found the correct political mechanisms and organizations yet to capitalize on this in the political realm and actually drive political change. I just don't think we have the vehicles or the people yet. But have faith. Yeah, have faith. I think eventually we will get these things. And as the problems with the system mount up, and as more people are switched over to our thinking, eventually there will come organizations, donors, and leaders who can move this forward politically. I just don't think we have those things yet. But we do have a certain amount of metapolitical capital. We've got organizations, we've got conferences, we've got webzines, we've got book publishing houses, and so forth. We've built up a lot of capital over the years, and it's been very, very difficult. Now, what I have seen over the last basically a year since Trump's election, it was almost a year ago that he was elected, is there was an MPI conference, which snatched defeat from the jaws of victory at the very end of Spencer's speech, has really created untold destruction, I think, of the networking capital that we were building up. And that was a terrible blow and a terrible mistake, but ever since then, people have just been doubling down on this basically fashy IRL memeing and LARPing. And this has led to Charlottesville. It's led to Gainesville. It's led to Shelbyville, Pikeville, all these other events over the year. And what don't we have anymore? Well, just at speaking in terms of Richard Spencer's operation, Radix is gone. Right On is gone. It's been replaced by an absolute tabloid, trashy, clickbait website that is basically a rather crude and stupid knockoff of the Daily Stormer now. That is a big loss. All these articles on Radix are gone. All this stuff that was published on Right On is gone. They took two things which were adding value, and they replaced it with something that's just a repugnant swamp of, as Jason Giorgiani put it, white trash, you know, sniping and bickering at one another, and articles with almost no intellectual content, and just ghastly press agent puffery of everything that Richard Spencer does, which is a real embarrassment. So anyway, that's what's been lost. Where's the new NPI conference? There was an NPI conference that was announced earlier this year. I see no sign that this is happening. It's supposed to be happening this month. Obviously, I don't think there is going to be an NPI conference. So we don't have Radix. We don't have Right On. We don't have an NPI conference this year, and we don't have an Identitarian Ideas conference this year.
I was going to say, I mean, that things have gotten so hot for Richard that now he can't even appear in Europe. I mean, they're going to keep doing this if he tries to speak at events here. And I know he probably thinks it's some sort of victory that, oh, you know, I'm so dangerous that they won't let me in. But it also means it makes it a lot more difficult to get stuff done.
Yeah, you can't do the networking, the community building, which is important metapolitical capital. You know, Christopher Dolny and Daniel Freeberg have been banned from coming to the United States. Now, I don't shed a tear over those two particular guys, especially Freeberg, who should not be involved in this movement at all. Nobody should have anything to do with him because he's a doxer and an embezzler, okay? But aside from that, the precedent that this sets is very, very ominous, because one of the most important things that we have going for us is an international movement and international cooperation among different ethno-nationalist groups in all the different white countries. And if that networking and cooperation is disrupted by travel bans and things like that, that is a huge loss. So what did we gain from Charlottesville? And what did we gain from throwing ourselves into all this activism? Well, just in terms of Spencer and Freeburg, two webzines are down, replaced with utter trash. Two conferences are down, replaced with nothing. And, you know, that's a lot of capital that was adding value, basically. Organizations and platforms and events that were adding value to the movement, and those are gone. And what did they gain from it? Well, a rally that didn't happen, a lot of bad press, and so forth. And let's also talk about the costs of Charlottesville. Those costs are going to be mounting up for years, just like the Iraq War bill has been mounting up for years. But if, say, 1,000 to 1,500 of our people went to Charlottesville for Unite the Right, let's just do some back-of-the-envelope calculations. Most of those people didn't come from the local area. Most of those people came from far away. Some of them came from clear across the country. Some of them booked plane tickets, hotels, rented cars. They had to pay for food. I would say, conservatively, that $500,000 was probably spent just on transportation, food, and lodging by these people. That's $500,000 that came from the pockets of our movement and went into the pockets of airlines, hotels, gas stations, restaurants. That's a criminal waste of our scarce resources on something that didn't actually help us at all. So that's something that's very bad. And then, of course, there are people who have lost their jobs. There are people who have all kinds of family problems as a result of this. There are people who were injured. Some of them potentially very seriously injured. They're going to still have medical bills. And there are people who have been arrested. And legal bills are mounting up for all of these things. Then, of course, you have to add in the deplatforming. VDARE, AMREN, Countercurrents. We all suffered from this. The Daily Stormer suffered the worst. We have taken a big hit. Just to be frank, I'll be transparent about this. Nobody else has to, but Countercurrents took a big hit in our finances. We are in a hole because of this. So I am looking at a catastrophe here. Again, a lot of platforms, webzines that were built up painstakingly over the years are threatened by the consequences of this rally. And let's just grant that there were some positive things that came out of Charlottesville. I don't know what they are. Let's just grant that there are some. Are they big enough to offset the enormous costs to the movement? What I feel that we are facing right now and that we have seen in all of 2017 is this. Years and years of institution building and capital, human capital, institutional capital, and financial capital accumulation are being basically burned up. It's like the Quakeutl Indians and their potlatch ceremonies, where in order to gain prestige in their community, the people who are vying for power would take property and give it away, and then if that didn't work, they would destroy it. They would have a bonfire, and they'd throw blankets in the bonfire and physical goods. And I feel like these rallies and these college events that Spencer did, like in Gainesville, which cost $10,000 just to get the room and untold thousands more for people, you know, legal bills, travel costs, and things like that. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of capital. And I think it's being thrown into a bonfire like a potlatch. And a bunch of narcissists are prancing around, dancing around the bonfire, you know, throwing the movement, burning it up in order to get some face time on TV. It's not a good deal for us. I think it's setting us back. And this is why I was so delighted when Andrew Anglin came forward and Nicholas Fuentes came forward and James Alsup came forward. Those last two are young guys to watch. I think they're very impressive and they've got a great future ahead of them. They came forward and they said, look, we have to have a conversation about whether activism like this is good at all. And of course, people immediately shoot back the response, well, we can't win by just staying online. No, we can't. We can't win just by staying online. The question is not whether we have real-world activism, but when and what kind.
Well, if this stuff they were doing could be successful, then George Lincoln Rockwell would have been president in the 1960s.
You're right, exactly.
It's basically the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. I really agree. And I think what we have to do is we have to have the conversation, is this the best kind of activism, and is this the best time for it? Are we ready for it? I don't think we're ready for it. Now, one thing that I thought was very healthy after Charlottesville 2, the disaster, right? was people started coming around to the idea that we need to take a page from the identitarians. I said this before the thing happened, but nobody listens to me, right? All these people who say you shouldn't go public with criticisms, you should keep it behind the scenes, they don't know how this movement really works. There was a time earlier this year when I reached out to somebody, I won't say who, you know, on Skype. I sent a Skype message to somebody saying, wait a second, we need to have a little conversation about something like this. And I was just dismissed and rebuffed in the rudest possible way. So the people who say that we need to have private conversations, they don't understand that private conversations don't exist when you have egomaniacs who refuse to listen and only double down on their folly, right? You have to go public on this stuff because you can't persuade the people who are doing the dumb things. You have to go to their supporters and you have to work that way. And that means you've got to go public. So having a public conversation about this is necessary. And the very people who say that we have to keep it private are the ones who don't listen to any private criticism. They're just trying to shut things down, basically. Okay. So we have to bear that in mind. Within my lifetime, Eastern Europe went from a communist hellhole to a bastion of freedom, which is an amazing transformation. So why should I be totally surprised that Andrew Anglin is now the voice of reason and moderation in the white nationalist world? But he has come out with very rational positions on this matter. He said we need to graft our activism onto the American tradition rather than do the Nazi stuff and the fascist stuff and the KKK stuff. And we need to have a conversation about whether or not this kind of activism is wise and whether or not this is the time for it. And of course, the Daily Stormer got hit harder by this than any other group. So they have reason and they've got data to look at. They see the damage this has done. It's damaged our capital. It's damaged our infrastructure. It's damaged our movement. And it's been a catastrophe. We need to step back from this and regroup. And we need to go forward with a smarter model. And the smarter model is, as I said before Charlottesville 2, to do something like the identitarians do. The first Charlottesville event was not publicly announced. It was very disciplined. They had did their torchlight rally and so forth. It was very photogenic. They covered it. They got the information out there about it. And then the press did its thing and the public did its thing. That's the model that the identitarians use. And it was a low cost, high impact, very aesthetic, very disciplined event. And no one died, right? So we need to do more of that. That is the model of activism that we need to embrace for the near future. And I'm hoping that groups like Identity Europa will do that. I think that they sort of were looking to that as a model, and I think more of that will happen. So let's hope that that's the model going forward until objective events change enough, until enough people are on our side in the public, we have enough public supporters, and until we have built up our capital and our ability to reach more people. We're not just talking about building it up, we're talking about making up lost ground right now. And let me tell you also one thing, anecdotally speaking, that I can attest to is after Charlottesville, a lot of people went dark. A lot of people disappeared in my social media world. A lot of people just left.
Same for me.
Yeah. And what's happening there is very simple. They don't think that the present course is working. And they might not be scared. Some of them are. But they might just be thinking, I need to hang back and watch and wait for a while and see if somebody comes up with a better model to carry this thing forward. They're not changing their minds. Nobody who truly believes the things that we believe ever changes back to being a liberal Democrat or a cuckservative. It just doesn't happen. It happens with crazy people. It happens with people who, you know, adopt ideas and discard them based on fashion or peer group and things like that. But it doesn't happen to people who base their ideas on reality and arguments. So these people aren't leaving our cause. They're just going dark and they're watching and waiting and they're hoping that something better comes along. And as that happens, I think a large crowd of other people is joining them because events are driving them in our direction. But they're not seeing something that they want to get behind and support. And I think that we need to take a step back from this activism, the model of activism that we've got going on, which I think is harming us more than it's helping us. And we need to do some empirical studies. We need to start polling people. And next week, we are going to roll out a poll for our readership, which is something that has to be done. Every political movement polls its people, its supporters. Every business, every industry polls its supporters. We don't do it. We're so far behind the curve on things like that. So we're going to start doing that. We need to start polling, thinking, calculating, and coming up with some new ideas. And now that winter is basically here, literally winter, not just metaphorical winter, winter is basically here. A lot of activism is going to cease anyway because of weather and so forth. I think people need to start taking this as a time of reflection. And I'm hoping that the spring of 2018 will mark a new era, basically, a beginning of something new. There will be new vehicles, new platforms. We'll have recovered from the setbacks that we've endured in 2017. We'll have some new ideas, and maybe some of these ideas will actually move this thing forward. So that's my hope.
Now, I know what you're saying is correct, Greg, because I've heard from a number of people myself that they're looking for such a thing, and they're not happy the direction that things are going in, and they want to see something else. So, yeah, it's definitely true. I have no way of gauging what percentage there is, but I've got to believe it's pretty sizable.
Yeah, Mike, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, you gave a little bit of a monologue, but I thought everything you said was good. I don't really have that much to add to it, aside from saying I do hope that after this period of reflection and taking a step back, that we do figure out some way of proceeding with activism that where we don't abandon the public space and retreat entirely just to the online world.
I agree. But it has to be intelligent. It has to be low cost and low risk and high reward, because we just don't have money to burn. And we burned up a lot this year, and we don't have money to burn, and we don't have lives to burn. We don't have people to burn. There were people who suffered very serious negative consequences after these events. And yeah, you can say to them, well, surely you knew that some of this was possible, but a lot of them didn't really think through this whole thing, and they didn't realize just how much pressure would come down on them. They didn't realize they're going to lose their jobs and things like that. They just didn't get it. So, yeah, we need to protect our people. Our people are precious. People who are switched on and who are willing to actually go out there with an uncovered face and advocate for our ideas, these people are precious, and we cannot treat them like cannon fodder just so some e-celeb leaders can get some FaceTime on TV. That is just criminal. It's a criminal misuse of people. It's a criminal betrayal of people's trust. And we can't do that. People trust in leaders, right? They think, okay, well, gee, this could go wrong in this way or that way, but I'm sure they've got it all worked out. And no, they don't. They don't have it all worked out. And they can't indemnify you against the losses that you might suffer by attending these events. They can't. They can't indemnify you. They won't even help you with your legal expenses. They're not going to help you with making rent when you lose your job and you've spent all of your liquid assets on coming to a rally. These people aren't going to do that. And so we've got to be careful, and we've got to respect the people who are willing to do this. Respect the activists. Don't use them as cannon fodder. And I think that kind of ethos is one of the things that sets the identitarians apart. They're not a movement that is driven by basically e-celebs, although, you know, Martin Sellner certainly emerged as an e-celeb, but he's not doing it for himself. I think that's very obvious. So we have to look to their ethos and to their tactics. I think that is the way forward in the near future. We can't abandon the public realm, but we have to recognize that the public realm is owned and controlled by the U.S. government. And
yes,
we don't have the power to challenge that.
This isn't Buy America yet.
It's not Buy America yet. Yeah. That's just a meme, guys. It's just a meme. And yeah, these Antifa are LARPing like communists in the 30s, but they're just LARPing. They don't have the power to bring down a government, which is what the communists did in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, early 30s. They don't have that kind of power today, and we don't have that kind of power today. So we have to stop this LARPing. Stop this LARPing nonsense. And think rationally about how we can do the best we can with our limited resources. And again, conserve the most precious resources, which are the people who are willing to come forward and do stuff. Those people are golden. I respect those people. They should not be exploited. And I feel like a lot of these people came away from Charlottesville feeling like they had been exploited and then just dropped. And so I think we cannot do that in the future. So yeah, this has been, I've been monologuing a bit. I apologize, guys. I've just been thinking a lot about this. You guys have had a much more fun weekend than I did. I was watching Shelbyville and reading lots of discussions online. You guys were in Slovenia for a Liebach event. So let's transition to that. What happened and what are your thoughts?
Well, there was announced this, I think they just call it the special Liebach event. Should I assume that people know what Liebach is who are listening, Greg?
Give us a little bit of background about them. Can't hurt.
Well, for those who don't know, Liebach, they've been around since 1980 in Slovenia, although they very quickly established an international presence already by the mid-80s. They started out as a very harsh, industrial, almost you could say art project. And then starting in the late 80s, they gradually transitioned, and they've never really lost that hard edge, but their later music is more recognizably, you know, rock music. Or, that's almost an insufficient word. I mean, they've gone through many different genres over the years, but it's always got a very distinctly Liebachian flavor to it. And I would say they do totalitarian aesthetics better than any of the, you know, either the fascists or the communists ever did it. Because you see, they have a, not just their music, but also their performances are always very carefully crafted to project this idea that they're actually like a state. In fact, they even founded a state called Neue Slowenische Kunst, which in German means New Slovenian Art. And as well, this art movement had painting and sculpture. And if you look at their work, it's just mind-blowing, at least to me, when I first discovered it. They basically took the most radical elements of fascist and communist art and kind of deturned it, to use the French term, to kind of reflect not an ideology, because they've never advocated for any specific political program, but more of an aesthetic. And they have occasionally applied themselves to actual political issues, like they were certainly crucial in the undermining of communism in late Slovenia and Yugoslavia with some of their activities, because they would take like Communist Party slogans and put them on Nazi posters. And the problem was that it still made perfect sense, even in that context. So it kind of undermines the credibility of the regime in some ways. And then later in the 1990s, they gave a very famous concert in Sarajevo while it was still under siege. And of course, our friend Charlie Kraft was actually their official photographer on that tour. But anyway, so, you know, Liebach has been around now for nearly 40 years, and I've been following them since 1996. I've always just found them incredibly fascinating. And, oh, I should also mention that the name Liebach itself is the original German name of Ljubljana, which is the capital of Slovenia. And, well, actually, I don't know if it's the original name, but I know during the Austro-Hungarian Empire and during the Third Reich, that was the name of the city. So it has quite a resonance in Slovenian history. This event was announced. It was this called Special Liebach Event, and it included a tour of Trebolje, which is a small coal mining town in Slovenia, which is where all the original Liebach members were from, which was conducted by one of the original members of the group who left it shortly after the group was founded, but he was with them in their early days. And then there was a dress rehearsal by the band itself for their upcoming tour, which actually begins in Budapest this Saturday. It's an album of music they did to accompany a stage performance of Nietzsche's Also Sprach Zarathustra. And then after that, there's a mountain near Trebolje named Mount Kum, which is, I believe, one of the, if not the tallest mountain in Slovenia. And you can see it, this place where the party was held. There was a documentary that Laibach made in the 1980s called Victory Under the Sun. It's on YouTube. There's a sequence that they did. It's almost like a music video to accompany their song, The Great Seal, which is from their most fascist album, Opus Dei, that's filmed in this space where we were. So that was quite fascinating. And we had opportunities to meet the band members. Like, I had a brief conversation with Ivo Saliger, who was one of the original members of the band and has been active with them continuously since 1980. Although he doesn't perform with the group anymore, but he's sort of still involved with them behind the scenes. And all in all, it was a fascinating event. You know, I dreamed of going to Tribolia and seeing Laibach there for 20 years. So it was really a fantastic opportunity. And Slovenia itself, you know, we saw quite a bit of it from the train windows. I mean, it's just a gorgeous countryside. Most of the country is in the Alps, and you just see these almost like storybook villages tucked away, you know, in the folds of these mountains and valleys. And Ljubljana, the capital city, is extremely nice. You know, it's a Habsburg style city, quite small because the entire population of Slovenia is only 2 million people. So the Ljubljana is quite small, even by European capital standards. But I thought it was great. You know, there's art and culture everywhere. They're obviously a deeply cultured people who really appreciate the value of art. Especially in public spaces, and excellent restaurants and food to be had. And it was overall our time there. I thought was great. And I look forward to going back there at some point and spending some more time. What was your impression of it, Mike?
I thought it was spectacular, both getting to go to this concert and the intimate setting of the after party. And getting up to Mount Kum and getting to see the location of some of the music videos that Laibach had filmed that I've seen in their, I think their Watt album.
Watt,
yes. German. But yeah, it was a wonderful experience. The countryside as you get into Slovenia becomes very mountainous, you know, as you head towards the Alps, and you know, whereas Hungary is much more flat, and being able to experience that, I actually took the bus from Budapest going in, which is actually a little bit faster than the train. I wasn't expecting that. And it was scenic because, you know, I mean, there were still, you know, large windows on the bus, but, you know, the train was definitely much better sense of the lay of the land and, you know, the mountains. It was gorgeous to see. And Ljubljana itself was a beautiful city, historic, has a nice historic downtown with a river and an old castle. I learned a lot more about the history meeting with the local identitarians that you had established contact with, John.
Yeah, they were great. They were great guys.
Yeah. And it was fun meeting them and just hanging out. And I had a great time.
Great. Great. That sounds wonderful.
I'm going to, just so people know, I'm waiting till after the Laibach concert this Saturday, and then I'm going to write all of this up into a nice article for Countercurrents next week. But being in Tribolia, even though I'd been following Laibach for over 20 years, I really understand a lot better where they're coming from now. It's almost, I don't think it's too much to say that you can't fully understand their aesthetic without having seen Slovenia and Tribolia itself and knowing something about the history. Like, a lot of the things that people think are fascist elements of their work are in fact things that are traditional to either Slovenia or Tribolia. Like, the band is, you know, one of their trademarks is they always wear these all black military looking uniforms that everyone always assumed were supposed to look fascist. But in fact, those are modeled after the traditional miners outfits that the miners of Slovenia wore historically, or the fact that they sing many of their songs, they sing in many different languages, but many of them are in German. You know, I think some people in the West saw that as them, you know, deliberately trying to seem fascistic. But in fact, you know, Slovenia historically in the Holy Roman Empire was united politically with both Austria and Bavaria. So actually they are as much German as Slavic. So it's, it was very interesting. And a lot of the symbology of the town too is stuff that Laibach has used in their albums, which I had no idea about till going there. And Laibach has a lot more to do with coal mining and so forth than you might even realize just following their work.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that many of the other attendees of this after party had fascist sympathies.
No, not at all. In fact, a lot of them I would classify as liberals, at least the ones I talked to. I didn't talk to everybody there. There were quite a number of people there. But I didn't find too many like-minded people. That was okay. I mean, there is still, you know, I knew people who had a knowledge of Laibach and NSK that put my own to shame. So it was still interesting meeting them. But yeah, the idea that it's some kind of, you know, secret fascist band is really not true.
So, Mike, how long has it been since you started listening to Laibach? I remember, I guess, I first heard them in like 1999 or 2000. And I've been listening to them and following them surely since the year 2000.
It was right around then. I want to say 2003, a little later, 2003 or 2004, when their Vought album came out. I really started looking at their other music videos and discovering their older songs.
My favorite Laibach album in a lot of ways is still NATO. I think that is so wonderful. I love the techno elements to it. My very favorite now, just musically speaking, I guess sentimentally speaking, NATO is my favorite, but musically speaking, it's Spectre, one of their more recent albums, which I think is fabulous. I think the folk album is fabulous too. I love some things on Vought. My favorite thing is the remix and the video that goes with that of Das Spiel ist aus. I just love that song.
Oh, they're doing it on the current tour as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Although they've changed it somewhat. I noticed on the first half of their current show is, you know, of course, Also Sprach Zarathustra. The second half, as is usual with Laibach shows, you know, they do a selection of their older songs, but I noticed they changed the lyrics on some of them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay closer attention to that when I see them on Saturday and see if I can figure out, you know, what motives they might have had, but that is one of the ones they're doing.
So, John, you mentioned that you're going to write an article about Laibach, so I guess that's a natural segue into our Shop Talk segment. Countercurrents is going to be announcing in the coming days and weeks a lot of new titles, some of them long in the making, are going to press. The very day that this podcast is going up, we're announcing two new books coming out. One is Cynosura, the new novel by Tito Perdue. It's his most recent novel. And the other is North American New Right, Volume 2, long awaited. So those will be available. And I hope you'll scroll down and click buy. We're taking pre-orders for both of those now. And Cynosura is basically done, and Cynosura will be out next week. I've been going through the proof copy, and I'm going to upload a couple of corrections. Mike's going to do the Kindle, and he can do that very quickly. So basically, it'll be available over the weekend in Kindle, and we'll start shipping printing copies the following week. And the week after, we're going to be announcing up to 5 new titles. I'm very excited by this. We're going to start taking pre-orders for Francis Parker Yaki's The World in Flames, Anthony M. Ludovici's long, long-awaited autobiography, Confessions of an Anti-Feminist, Christopher Pankhurst's book, Numinous Machines, and Spencer Quinn's book, White Like You, which is a novel. So those are several of the titles that are in the works. And also, the fifth is J.A. Nichols' book, Venus and Her Thugs, which is a collection of his weird short stories. So there's a lot of new material coming out from Countercurrents this fall. So brace yourself. There's going to be a book blitz.
Well, is there anything else coming up that we should mention?
Gosh, I can't think of anything else. I've just got my nose to the grindstone trying to bring all these projects to fruition. John is editing away. We do have a new shopping cart that has been announced, and we have to give Mike kudos for that. That's finally set up. A lot of people were having difficulty after the deplatforming with putting in orders. That has been solved now. We've got a new, much more friendly shopping cart for people, much more user-friendly.
I wanted to add, too, shortly when you make a purchase within the next week or so, you should receive an email confirmation from us after the purchase is made, letting you know that the order has been received. And then again, once it's been shipped. So that'll come into effect sometime next week.
That's great. And also, from now until the 10th of November, there is a 20% off sale for select items. You can scroll down and you'll see the 20% off announcement on the front page at CounterCurrents. So we're doing that to encourage people to test our shopping cart by putting things in it and clicking buy. So we will give you many new opportunities with these pre-orders for new titles to also test out the shopping cart, put things in it, and click buy. So thank you all for not just being supporters and readers, but also customers of CounterCurrents. We've got a lot of new books coming to press, and I'm very proud of these books. They have great content, and they also look great, too.
Yeah. I love anything that Tito does. So that one in particular, I think people will find interesting. And also the Ludovici when I worked on that. If you're interested in his work, it's really fascinating. Fascinating book.
He had a fascinating life. He met a lot of interesting people. He has memories in there of meeting Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels and Gurdjieff and Chesterton, a lot of interesting figures. So he was a well-traveled and interesting man. So we will do a special podcast about the Ludovici Confessions of an Anti-Feminist. And next week, I'm going to try and do an interview with Tito about Sinishura. And we have a number of other Tito Perdue novels in the pipeline. The next ones will be called The Philatelist and Though We Be Dead, Our Day Will Come. So those are two novellas that are coming out as separate thin volumes. So that's coming up in coming months. And in the new year, we'll have a number of other Tito Perdue titles. So there's going to be a Tito Perdue renaissance soon.
Greg, you still have in stock, I think, some copies of The Lost Philosopher by Ludovici.
Right. From 2003, so I've been lugging around copies of The Lost Philosopher since 2003, and some of them are still available. One of the things that you and I need to iron out is the postage rates for those volumes, because we have to ship them all from the United States, and shipping them abroad is pretty expensive, so we need to get the shopping cart updated with those postage rates. The Ludovici and the Yaki volumes are both going to be released, like the Savigi Devi Lightning in the Sun edition that we did, in a numbered hardcover edition of 200 copies. And those will all be shipped from the United States where they'll be printed. And so we need to work out the postage rates for all of those. So when people do the pre-orders, they can, click, one copy to Canada or Europe or wherever the different postage zones are. So we need to get that all worked out. But yeah, those will be available in really nice collector's editions and limited collector's editions. And we're going to do all the Yaki volumes that way. There will be a limited edition, very high quality, library quality hardcover of 200 copies, 200 numbered copies. And then there'll be an unlimited paperback edition, of course, as many people who want to buy it. Most limited editions are limited only by the number of people who want to buy it. When people say limited edition, it often means nothing. But in the case of the hardcovers, there will be 200 copies each, strictly.
All right.
So I think that basically wraps it up. We've been going for more than an hour, so we don't want to impose any longer upon our listeners. So, Mike, John, thank you very much, and we will be back next week with another episode of CounterCurrents Radio.
See you next time, guys.
See you next week.